toward the One, the perfection of love, harmony, and beauty, the only being united with all the illuminated souls who form the embodiment of the Master, the Spirit of Guidance. Beloved ones of God, dear friends, it is a great pleasure to share this moment with you. I'm grateful to Sheikh Llewellyn Vaughan Lee for the invitation to come together. And I would like to express my heartfelt thanks to all who contributed to bringing together this gathering, and especially Cleary, who has brought us together with such thoughtfulness and care. And thanks to each of you who have come from all over the country and all over the world to be present for this special gathering. I'd like to begin this morning with a poem of a great Indian Sufi of the earlier half of the 20th century, Aziz Mian, which I've translated from Urdu together with Peter Lamborn Wilson. The title is Ishqi Mujarrad, which means abstract love. How can I, with neither tongue nor mouth, hope to explain or even try to speak? For no one strikes the lute that is oneself, but needs must someone else to pluck the chord. How shall I write the tale of separation, or burden of our sad and dual state? And yet I must, for someone bids me speak, who stands in my heart like a body resurrected. The seeker is reality itself. The seeker is reality itself, that yet still seeks its own essential being. Once it subsisted in its very essence, and then was free of every attribute. But then it felt the stirring of desire to search after itself within itself. Love is the name we give to such desire. And love is our requirement in that state. So far, this love exists as an abstraction, and thus demands no beauty for its object. But when it seems the wish is not fulfilled, the seeker's glance falls into its own depth. When it seems the wish is not fulfilled, the seeker's glance falls into its own depth, and thus it meets itself, whole and complete. Precisely here that beauty comes to birth, and here that abstract love is concretized. Reality is called Muhammad here, And when the seeker's gaze fell on that truth, a multicolored splendor there arose. One glance sufficed. His heart was filled with joy. Thus the first cycle came to its completion. Here it was the universe began. Be, and it was. Universal emanation. And at this point, duality appeared. Yet in a form that seemed not quite complete. For nowhere in it could be, for nowhere in it could a face be seen, nor body fit to ravish hearts with grace. He gave creation his own countenance, made it vicegerent, mirror of his face, and told the angels to prostrate before it as manager and master of the age. In time to come, this human race would flourish, turning the wheel of the work of the world below. In time to come, this human race would flourish, turning the wheel of the work of the world below. And still it lives, undying. Earthling's face, always the same. The restless face of love. Oh, when shall it be given to this love to know to what it has been sacrificed? How can it ever come to be aware? What in itself has fallen mad for love? The face is ignorant of how it lives to ravish hearts with its mysterious grace. O Raz, this secret will remain secret indeed. What is seduction? Coquetry. What does love need? In this poem, Aziz Mian describes the stages of the descent of the one being, the ultimate reality, from the solitude of the divine unity, eternal, changeless, ineffable, infinite, silent essence. Descending through the force of love, through successive spheres of emanation, in the abstract, in the angelic plane, in the jinn plane, the mind world, and through the successive spheres of cosmic evolution that have produced the universe and our planet and the life which lives here and the human being, successive stages of emanation which have culminated in our own precious lives. This process that Aziz Mia describes is our own genealogy, our own heritage. We have been brought here by a force of love. Half of our journey has already been completed. And with this love, we have developed interest at every level of our being, from the innermost core outward, coming to know each sphere of being. We have become interested in each sphere, and our interest has led us further and further outward to the very surface of manifestation. And here at the surface, we are held by our interest. This whole manifestation is a phenomenon of interest leading to attachment, leading to forgetfulness. For the continuation of our journey, the counterpart of interest becomes necessary. Detachment. Renunciation. The Sufis describe four stages of renunciation. The word for renunciation is tark. There are four tarks, four renunciations. The first is tarki dunya, the renunciation of the world. We all begin this journey at the same place with our ego, our primitive ego, our notion of ourself, our persona, who we think we are, which is just the very tip of our being. One could imagine an inverted cone with who we think we are as the mere bottom tip. This is our individuation. And this is necessary. It's necessary for us to live in this world, that we should have a sense of ourselves, of our needs. If a baby did not cry when it was hungry, the mother would not know when to feed it. It's built into our evolution. It's a survival mechanism. That is what is called the nafs al-amara, the level of our being, the level of our self, which must insist on its own prerogatives. Nafs al-amara means literally the commanding the self, the self which demands something, the self which expects something, the self which must have its way. That is necessary to be in this world, to have one's feet on the ground. One must claim what one needs. The animals know this. The animals take what they need. And yet, in the nafs of the animal, there is no malice. There is merely the fulfillment of one's need. When the nafs al-amara crosses a line, it is when it expects gratuitously, when it acts with malice or hostility, then the moral of this stage has been transgressed, and the moral is reciprocity. Protect yourself, but do not act with hostility. There's a wonderful story of the great Imam Hazrat Ali, Karamallahu Wajhu. He was in battle against the enemies of the faith community that would wish to destroy he and his friends. And he was locked in combat with one of these enemies and had subdued him and was about to take his life. And that man spat in his face. And Ali's face flushed. He was incensed. But rather than striking, he sheathed his sword and withdrew. And afterward, that man came to him and he said, "You had me. You could have killed me. And what is more, I insulted you. Your behavior is inexplicable. Why didn't you deliver the final blow?" Ali answered, "This battle was a battle of self-defense. You threatened our community, and I acted in the name of God. But when you spit upon me, you aroused my anger, my own personal pride, my hostility. And I could not act in anger." And when this man heard this explanation, he was overcome and ceased his hostility and became a friend and devotee of Ali. That is the moral of this stage: reciprocity. One may return at this level, one may return blow for blow. An eye for an eye and a tooth for tooth. If an animal is attacked, well, it will fight. The mechanism is flight or fight. It must do one or the other. There's a certain level in which we have to attend to our own needs. This is the level of Sharia. Now, this nafs al-amara, this individuated self, belongs to the dunya, the world. And this word dunya doesn't simply mean the world per se, but our image of the world. The illusion that we have of the world, what the Hindus call maya. We imagine the world to be separate from ourselves. We see the world outside and ourselves inside. And we see the world as a collection of distinct objects without an underlying unity. And we see our greatest good in the world as acquiring objects, possessing things, always getting more things, better things, improving the quality of our life, obtaining comforts and conveniences. In fact, our very society is based on these principles: economic growth, constant increase. Advertising depends on the expectation that we will always wish to have what is better, what is new. We are preoccupied with the images of things rather than the things themselves. Like the dog that had a bone in its mouth and looked into the reflection on the surface of the pond and saw another dog with a bone, wanted to have that bone, so it dropped its own bone and dove into the water. We're like that. Well, there is something to be said for striving for something, even for a material object, to attain something. And when one has attained something, when one is striving for something, that object is above one and you are below. But when you've attained it, you've become greater than that object. But if you hold it, if you remain attached, you sink down once again below that object. So one finds when one collects things that those things that one strived for, ultimately, in possessing, one doesn't have the satisfaction one longed for. One's heart comes to be a warehouse. One becomes the custodian of the things that one owns. One thinks one will be free if one could just secure this fund or this capital, this property. Then one could be free. And yet, more often than not, just the opposite is the case. In holding, one loses one's freedom. Rather than possessing, one becomes possessed. That's why the dervishes take vows of poverty. You see them glorious in their rags. There's a story of a dervish of the Himalaya mountains who was visited by Akbar, the great king, who was perhaps the wealthiest man in the world and most powerful in his age. And he had a great interest in fakirs. And he heard of a great dervish in the mountains and went to visit him. And of course, Akbar was accustomed to the etiquette of the court. When people would come into his presence, they would bow down on the floor before him and observe great etiquette of the court, servility, obsequiousness in his presence. In this case, when he went before this fakir, the fakir had his arms crossed like this and his legs out, which is just the opposite of what you are expected to do in the presence of a king. You should have your feet under and hands raised in supplication. So Akbar asked him, "How long have you been seated in this way?" And the fakir replied, "Since I have taken back my hands from the world, I have put my feet out to the world. Since I am no longer asking for something, I sit with pride and freedom." That is the posture of the dervish, who depends upon no one in this world. So one finds that it's not things themselves that will give one satisfaction. When one has acquired things, one realizes it wasn't the thing itself or the image of the thing. It was that I wanted to have a certain experience, and I thought that object would be a vehicle for me to have that experience. Really, what I was looking for was a sense of peace, and I thought I could have that if I surrounded myself with luxuries. Or I wanted an experience of joy or an experience of beauty. But gradually one comes to understand that those experiences are all autonomous of some kind of external relation of possession, which is just an illusion anyway. What can one really possess in this fleeting world of change? And so one longs to have experiences. And this may lead one to a teacher, someone in whose presence one begins to have those very experiences one is longing for, one whose very being represents the attunement, the state of mind and heart that one is longing to develop within oneself. And so one seeks a guide on the path. And in the Sufi tradition, this is essential. Well, you might ask, why should it be necessary to take guidance from outside? But so long as one one's mind is like a closed system that needs to be opened, one must learn receptivity. In order to progress, there comes a time when one must be prepared to unlearn, to be challenged in all of one's presuppositions. And this is the role of the teacher. Whatever teaching the teacher might give, still there is great significance in the very fact of opening one's mind and opening one's heart to that teaching. That in and of itself is of importance. There is a story of a young man who was the son of a renowned Pir-o-Murshid, a great teacher of Sufism who was revered throughout India. And all of the Murshids would come and offer their respects to this grand Murshid. And the son grew up in the basking in the glow of this great being. But one night this son had a dream that his father entered into an assembly, and he went to follow him to enter into that same assembly, and his way was barred. He was not allowed. And he woke up and felt terribly distressed. And he went to his father and said, "Please explain the meaning of this dream." And his father looked at him deeply and said, "Yes, something remains for you. You must go. I have a khalifa." This Murshid had many khalifas, many representatives. But he said, "I have one khalifa." This khalifa was a peasant who lived in the wilderness, an illiterate, very simple, humble peasant who was yet a representative of this Murshid. And so the father said to the son, "You must go to him. He must be your teacher. And when you have learned from him, come back and you may claim your heritage." So the son accepted his father's command, went into the desert, and he approached the village and saw then before him this khalifa who was mounted on horseback. And the son approached the khalifa and politely kissed his hand. And the khalifa looked at him sternly and said, "Lower." And the son of the Murshid bent down and kissed his foot. And the khalifa looked at him and said, "Lower." And the son of this great Murshid, who had grown up in this atmosphere of great prestige, satisfaction, bent down and kissed the knee of the horse. And the Murshid said, the Khalifa said, "Lower." And he kissed the hoof of the horse. And at that moment, the Khalifa lifted him up, looked deeply in his eyes, and said, "Your training is completed. Go back to your father." Every teacher has once been a student. If one has never been a student, how could one be a teacher? So through this way, one comes more and more to resonate with one's teacher, to receive the teaching, and not to confront the teaching with one's own preconditioned thought processes, to open the heart, to open the mind, to be receptive, to assimilate, to integrate, to practice. In this way, one imbibes a tradition that has been transmitted, passed down in the same way for generations after generation, centuries after century. One enters the way. And more one's own nafs al-amara softens and opens up and becomes, as it grows, a new kind of sense of self. No longer the commanding self, but now the reflective self, the self-critical self that does not immediately assume its own prerogatives, that is patient, that is not quick to judgment, that does not merely react. The self begins to see the larger picture, the context. And so there's a further level of morality here. This is not merely one has gone beyond the support system. The nafs al-amara is merely the support system. And as we've seen, the support system has a tendency to take over. If you are planning an expedition, you have to have a base camp, and that base camp is the nafs al-amara. You have to have a base of operations. But if one settles there feeling comfortable, it's like setting up camp at the base of Mount Everest and then living in your base camp. There's a exploration that awaits one. So here one no longer attends merely to one's immediate needs, but sees that if one is confronted with hostility, one tries to understand the underlying reasons. What caused someone to act in that way toward you? For example, one could consider the case of our response as a nation to the terrible tragedies of September 11th. The first reaction that many of us felt, certainly the most common reaction still to this day, is the feeling of a need for security, a need to heighten, to fortify one's boundaries, the borders, fortify the borders, heighten security, to neutralize potential threats. That is the level of the nafs al-amara. That is the level of reciprocity. But at this further level, one looks more deeply and looks toward a longer term and sees that the threat has its own the threat itself comes out of a culture. It comes out of a situation. So one looks deeply into the state of the world. How, at this level, the organism wishes to not merely react to its environment, but to work creatively with its environment. An organism that is successful in evolution not only adapts itself to its environment, but adapts its environment to itself. It attempts to create harmony in its atmosphere so it will not be confronted with threats. In this way, one learns to take care. One sees that one is part of a global system. And one, as this is the nafs al-lawama, self-critical, what part do I play in this global system? What am I contributing to the state of the world? Do I have any role in the grievances of people throughout the world? Am I cooling? Am I cooling the fires that are blazing, or am I fanning the fires? And to a certain extent, one must consider one's role in politics and in economy. But more important than any vote that one may cast is the way that one relates to those around one in daily life. One's family, one's friends, one's acquaintances, those one meets. One realizes that in treating each one that we meet, in seeing the face of God in each person, we may contribute to the peace of the whole world. That is a further stage of morality. That is the level of beneficence. Turn the other cheek. One is prepared not merely to react in anger, but to do more for the other than has been done to oneself. To offer good for evil. This is the tariqah. And at this stage, one begins to see the guidance that is coming through one's teacher. One resonates with that guidance and discovers it in oneself also. One's teacher is a channel of guidance, but that guidance is coming from all sources, from everyone whom one meets, and one discovers it very deeply within oneself. There is a wonderful story of a murshid who approached a man who was not, well, this was a man who was had some very bad habits. And this murshid came to him and said, I feel the impulse to offer you initiation, to offer you entry into the spiritual way. And this man said, Murshid, I have such great esteem for you, such respect for you. But such as I could never be your murid. I do terrible things. And the murshid said, well, what do you do? And he described his sins. And the murshid looked at him and said, I will accept you as a murid on the condition that you do not do those things in my presence. And this man was surprised. He said, well, Murshid, how could I ever do those things in your presence? I would never think to do that. So he said, then I give you bayat. Offered him his hand in initiation. You know, initiation means taking hand. It means pledging to travel the path together in companionship. He gave him his hand, he gave him his trust. And then that man went back to his life, went back to his neighborhood. And would have a tendency, he'd have an inclination to do those bad things, whatever they were. But whenever he would go to do them, he would feel the presence of his murshid. And so it happened that he transformed himself. The presence of his murshid wasn't only embodied in his physical presence, he assimilated it within himself. So that's a further stage. That's the first stage was fana fi sheikh, the annihilation in the murshid. And now one is approaching fana fi rasul, annihilation in the messenger, the spirit of guidance. One discovers that the universe is speaking to one and has been speaking to one since one's very birth, through one's mother, who was one's first teacher, from whom one, in an atmosphere of nourishment, of love, one gracefully, gracefully came into a sense of one's self. The mother is the first guru. And through one's father, and through one's teacher, and through one's friends, through all of these channels, the voice of guidance is speaking. And that same voice is speaking within oneself. You know, there is an ayah in the Quran Sharif, in Surat Al-Azab, which says that the Prophet is closer to you than you are to yourself. Well, that sounds at first like a kind of oxymoron. How could anyone be closer to me than to the self than the self? Well, and yet our sense of self is always changing, isn't it? Are we the same person that we were 5 years ago, 10 years ago? You might feel that you're more yourself now than you ever were. And maybe in the future you'll be even more yourself. And so there is, within oneself, there is something that is essential to one's being, one's interface with reality itself. And that is the manifestation of the spirit of guidance, which is most perfectly embodied in the prophets, the messengers of all the world's religious traditions. And if we follow a particular faith, the prophet of our own faith becomes our exemplar, the embodiment of the spirit of guidance, the perfection of that manifestation of the divine in humanity. And more one discovers that spirit of guidance in all manifestation and in nature. There's a wonderful story of Murshid Samuel Lewis, who was a great spiritual leader of the hippie era in San Francisco. And he was once giving a talk, and someone came in from the street, and full of the intoxication of his own ego, this person began shouting and shouted toward Murshid Sam and said, God has commanded me to be your spiritual guide. And Murshid Sam looked at him and said, I accept, on the condition that you show me one person in this room who is not my spiritual guide. That's a manifestation of fana fi rasul. So in this stage, one has gone beyond the dunya, our crude, primitive, separated image of the world of a world which, in our own time, is becoming more and more uniform, more and more same, and yet never more present. we have uniformity without unity. That is the tragedy of the globalization of the nafs al-amara, of the lowest, most basic level of our being, the support system, rather than the globalization of the higher levels of our being at which we experience overcoming of the alienation, of separation, discovering unity in diversity. This is akhira, the hereafter, the heaven. And one gradually, through spiritual practice, one feels a transformation. Through the awakening of the light of the spirit of guidance, one's subtle physiology becomes awakened. We have the most remarkable capacities within ourselves that are dormant, latencies. We use just the smallest percentage of our potential. This very body is the culmination of eons of cosmic evolution guided by the force of love, culminating in our manifestation for the fulfillment of the divine intention. As my grandfather used to say, this body is a gift from the whole universe, a clay which has been kneaded for eons, matter that has been transformed and evolved to become radiant, living, an ideal receptacle for the manifestation of the essence. And as we awaken our capacities, as we awaken the heart center, which is the very locus of integration, the very place where heaven and earth may be mingled, in this way, we experience sensations undreamed of. The Sufis sometimes offer lists of all the various different kinds of lights which the seeker perceives. Colored lights, blazes, very fine sparkles, states of ardor, of serenity, all manner of modes of ecstasy. This is akhira, which is symbolized in the language of religion as the pleasures of the garden of paradise, the kind of experiences that we yearned for in dunya, here felt in their pure, pristine form. And yet, as one advances, one may come to the point where one feels that yet all of this is another veil. A veil of great beauty, and yet it is another condition. And what one is seeking is a state beyond conditioning. All of these states are states that come and go. But in the divine being, in the solitude of the divine being, there is no coming and going. There is sheer luminous presence. And one may come to feel that one has become distracted, deluded. Bastami called out, "Khada, khada, hoax! I have been waylaid. My object is only thee." and Rabia al-Adawiya used to say, "O Lord, if I worship you for the pleasures of heaven, deny me those pleasures. And if I worship you to escape hell, then give me the fire of hell. But if my worship is sincere, is for the sake of your own essence, do not deny me the grace of your presence."